This is a really important newscast, and these are the stories I think that you need to know about today. There is an uprising of sorts. Some would even say it's a civil war that's taking place right now in America. And it pits the forces of Tucker Carlson on one side against the forces of Ben Shapiro on the other. The BBC does a fake edit of a Trump speech, and it's causing a rift between the Trump administration and the UK. I'm going to show you exactly how they did it and what they did. An incredible video of part of a brigade of the Ukrainian army walking off the battlefield with their arms up in the air. They're giving up. We're going to show it to you. It's an amazing video here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. There is a massive pushback against politicians in the United States. It's happening right now. And this is not really about party affiliation. It's just about politicians in general. It's because they use their jobs to make money at the expense of the people that they're supposed to serve. And why do they do it? Well, the real question is, why can they do it? Why can they get away with this? Because it's legal. It's legal. Yes. For those of you who are not familiar with the U.S. laws, the Supreme Court of the United States passed a law back in 2010 saying it is perfectly okay for corporations and special interests like AIPAC to buy politicians in the United States, bribe politicians in the United States. And since then, they have been doing just that. But now they're starting to get pushback from ordinary citizens. Some call it the great awareness that's taking place right now in America. It may be. Look, no matter what you call it, though, there's no doubt that there's something going on here. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what we're talking about here. And these occurred just recently. The first one has to do with a guy named Joe Manchin. There he is. The West Virginia politician has taken millions of dollars from every big U.S. corporation that you can name or he can get his hands on. And then, not surprisingly, he ends up protecting their interests. He does what they would have wanted. He has opposed laws that would have, for example, helped workers have more protections, have more days off. He's kept things like family leave from happening, kept things like maternity for women from being enforced and given as a right to people in the United States. He stopped lower drug prices laws from being passed. By the way, those things that I just mentioned, those are all things that are the status quo around the world. It's the status quo in India, status quo in Russia, status quo in China. So instead, this guy, Manchin, has taken money from companies that don't want those things to happen, don't want those things to pass, because they want to save money. By the way, it's important to note that if he took money that way, as he apparently has, as most politicians do, it's not just him, so openly and so brazenly, but he was a politician, let's say, in China or India or Russia, he'd go to jail. He'd go to jail. But in the U.S., it's perfectly legal. Perfectly legal. It's amazing. Citizens, though, now, not the media, citizens are starting to fight back. And they are calling him out. Watch this video.
You've sold our futures and you've gotten rich doing it, you sick. How dare you? Come on, you have sold our future. I've received more funding from fossil fuels than any other senator.
You've made millions out of your position. You drive a Maserati.
The Valley Pipeline goes right through West Virginia, which are your constituents. The Mountain Valley Pipeline will eventually be one of the many pipelines that will eventually get to everybody.
You have to say for yourself.
We'll get back on track here, guys.
Our futures, not your profits.
Good for them. They're right. They're absolutely 100% right. I think we need more people like that. That video, by the way, is going viral on the internet. And there's another one that I'm going to be showing you here. This one's really fascinating because this is a story of a guy who doesn't even want to address what people are saying. He's trying to shut them up. That's him right there, Jake Auchincloss. He's like 90% of the U.S. Congress, past and present, the U.S. Senate, past and present, the U.S. Cabinet and Congress and the president's past and present. They all take money from Israeli donors and from the Israeli lobby AIPAC. And watch what happens, though, when this guy tries to have a town hall with his constituents. He tells them he doesn't want to talk about it. Don't want to talk about it, but they keep going. They keep talking about it. They keep asking him about it. And, you know, they're just not going to let up. They will not be silenced. Pardon the vertical format on this video, but this is why this video in part has gone viral. This is an important aspect of the story. Watch their relentlessness.
I wondered whether if you had not accepted AIPAC money, whether you'd change your feeling about speaking about Israel-Palestine.
I think we as citizens and as policymakers have to hold in our heads competing convictions and ideas.
Me personally, I'm concerned with AIPAC, and I was just wondering if you particularly or anyone you know of has any plans to try to reduce this problem.
What are you doing to prevent the use of our taxes to starve and kill people in Gaza?
Yeah.
You were elected by us. Remember that.
I've addressed Israel and Gaza now on, I think, three separate occasions. So we're going to keep moving on.
So I know you don't really want to take any more questions about Gaza, but I'm going to ask you to think about it.
Starvation is not what my tax dollars should go to.
So I hear the sense of emotional urgency behind Gaza. I've addressed that issue. I'm not going to continue to address the issue.
An amazing moment. Makes me feel good. Let's talk about another case of pushback that is also getting really hot in America right now. I mean, my country's heating up over things like this. Conservative and some Democratic voices in America are arguing forcefully that elected officials should not be doing the bidding of other countries. That is what non-establishment media figures like myself, like Judge Napolitano, like Colonel Doug McGregor, so many others, right, have been saying now for years. I got fired for saying it more than 20 years ago, by the way. Lost my job. But today, the person saying it the loudest of all today is Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson has been relentless on this. His point is simple. Politicians should stop putting the interest of other countries, be it Ukraine, be it Israel, whoever, ahead of the interests of the United States and its citizens. Because of that, Tucker Carlson right now is being assailed, relentlessly attacked in the United States by certain people. Take a listen to the first one.
Tucker Carlson has turned himself into a conspiracist and a crank and a pathological liar. Tucker excuses Vladimir Putin's murderous and barbarous reign. He has even become one of his most ardent defenders. Tucker Carlson has attacked President Trump as a cover-up artist for sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein on behalf of Israel and Mossad, making sure, of course, never to mention President Trump's name, because, of course, Tucker's a coward. Tucker Carlson acts as an ideological launderer for other people's evils. He's a master of gaslighting. Tucker Carlson will have on a Hitler-friendly pseudo-historian to minimize the Holocaust and blame Winston Churchill for World War II. Tucker Carlson will have on over and over a pro-Chinese propagandist who used global warming to promote global socialism, all in order to criticize Israel and hug China.
I know Tucker Carlson. Ben Shapiro is wrong. Ben Shapiro, by the way, travels to Israel regularly and is an avid and devoted supporter of Bibi Netanyahu and his government. And many would argue that he, Ben Shapiro, is much more in support of Israel than he is the United States. He's not alone. Here's another one. Mark Levin. He's considered one of the most profitable, one of the most recognizable talking heads in United States television, certainly among Republicans. He's big over there on Fox News, for example. And he's just come out and viciously slammed a whole host of people, including Nick Fuentes. And of course, he saves the best for last, Tucker Carlson.
Little Adolf Fuentes, little Adolf. He gets here, he's got a little suit on like he's attending a funeral. My advice to little Adolf is just go full, put the brown shirt on. What are you, a coward? Put the brown shirt on. I know you can't grow the Hitler mustache, you're still stuck in your prepubescent stage, but give it a shot. give it a shot. To Tucker Carlson, I say, did you have a head injury? What happened to you? But you know what? Unlike other people, truly, I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't care why. I just know what you are. You platform these people. You deceive your audience. You lie to your audience. You become a full-blown, out-of-the-closet Jew hater. And if you're a Jew hater, you're a Christian hater. And they demonstrated that. Christian Zionism.
And the friction does not stop there. There's also friction between the Trump White House and the UK. And it has to do with the BBC, the state-owned media network with the recent history of being more of a public relations department, really, for MI6 and for the UK administrative state than it is a real news outlet. Watch them. This is what is making Mr. Trump so angry, though. This is what is making Mr. Trump so angry. So they did a documentary about January 6th, the BBC did, and they took a statement by Mr. Trump on that day, and they made it look like the president, Trump, was trying to force the protesters to riot and attack and kill people. And they did so by deleting many minutes out of his statement and then clipping it together. Watch this video. This is illustrative to see how they did it and what they actually did. On the left of your screen, you're going to see how they edited the video to make it look like a continuous statement, right? That's what they actually put in their documentary. But on the right, you're going to see what they omitted to do that dishonestly. Go ahead, Gene. Let's put it up for the folks.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and I'll be there with you, and we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
You see what they did there? They took that whole part out in the middle to make it look like he was saying something he wasn't saying. That's called context, taking something out of context. That is such an obvious breach of what we're taught as journalists when we go to journalism school by our professors. I mean, that's like rule number one. It's dishonest. It's wrong. They're trying to create a moment that really didn't exist, didn't happen. And it wasn't because they were trying to make it shorter. It's because they were trying to lie, right? Because of that, the head of the BBC's two top news executives have resigned or have probably been asked to leave, which is most likely what happened. Director General Tim Davie and news CEO Deborah Ternus are both now leaving the corporation. You want to know what I think as a guy who's been practicing journalism like this for decades now? My take? Yeah. What the BBC did to Trump was absolutely wrong. But because he's the president of the United States, and only because he's the president of the United States, they are admitting to this guilt. They're copping to it. So here's the truth. Let me tell you the truth, right, about the BBC. The BBC lies all the time. All the time. And they do much worse than what you just saw right there. They lie about China. They lie about India. They lie about Iran and many, many other countries. And, of course, to them, lying about Russia and the war in Ukraine, it's like breathing. They never stop doing it. So spare me if you're thinking that they perhaps did the right thing here by firing some people. No, wrong. You know why they did it? They did it because the United States is an important ally and they want to kiss their butts, right? That's why they did it. Which shows once again that the BBC is more of a political operation, follow me, a political operation than it is a journalistic operation. There, I said it. On to Ukraine. where the story is best captured by this video. In the moment, these soldiers are part of the Ukraine Armed Forces 38th Marine Brigade. They are surrendering. Here's what happened. The Russian military was mopping things up there and doing reconnaissance when they identified a grouping of soldiers hiding in the woods. The Russians dropped leaflets to them, offering them a chance to surrender. The brigade leader then reached out to the Russian commanders and said, "We're putting down our weapons and we're coming out." The scene is being repeated with more and more frequency in and around this area around Pokrovsk. It's amazing to watch, though, isn't it? Look at that. Wow. The other big headline coming from eastern Kupiansk. It's a strategic important city in Ukraine's Kharkov region. So let me see. We could put it up on the map. There you go. Much like Pokrovsk, this is another vital outpost that was being used by Ukraine's military as a key supply hub. That is no longer the case. Russia's defense ministry in Moscow announced today that eastern Kupiansk has now been taken, as well as now being under control, says the Russian defense ministry. According to the official statement that they put out, all Ukrainian units have been encircled. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky denies the report. He's saying the city is actually still being successfully repelled. Russian officials, who usually are pretty terse about this kind of stuff, reacted to that statement somewhat angrily. They say the statement that Mr. Zelensky put out is, quote, detached from reality. When we come back, we're going to chat with a historian and an author who also happens to be a former Australian government official. And the reason I'm calling on him is because he has a YouTube channel where he's recently dropped some pretty fascinating insights into how the Ukraine war's real causes can be traced back to somebody else. You know how we're always told it was all about Obama, it's all about, you know, Biden and those characters? Well, he says no, it was somebody else who actually got the ball rolling, who actually started this mess in Ukraine. And the person he names is Dick Cheney. We're going to talk about this. You stay right there. We'll be right back. So I want to introduce you to Jeff Rich. I was doing some research the other day, and part of what I love to do when I do research is read and watch different videos that are being put out by different people. And I came across this gentleman. His name is Jeff Rich. He's a historian. He hosts the Burning Archive in Substack and on YouTube as well. That's his channel. He's worked for a number of different Australian state agencies. And he has created an environment where he's able to explain to us how exactly the Ukraine war started. And let me tell you what I came away with here, because we report on this all the time. And we're always having people talk about the fact that Ukraine's war started. And Jeff is sitting there waiting to see what the hell I'm going to say. But that the Ukraine war was started by Biden, that Ukraine story was started by Hillary Clinton, by Bill Clinton, by Obama. And there's certainly some truth to all of those things. But no, says Jeff. He says it actually started way before any of those characters. He puts much of the blame on Dick Cheney. And I thought, wow. What an interesting way of looking at this, especially given the fact that Vice President Cheney recently passed. I wanted to have him on so he could take us through this. So, Jeff, thank you for joining us, my friend.
You're very welcome, Rick. It's a real pleasure and honor to be on your show.
It's an honor for us. So start us off. Take us back to how Dick Cheney created this fiasco that we now know as the Ukraine War.
Well, it really takes us back to the year when the Soviet Union collapsed, and also, you know, the couple of years at the end of the Cold War after Mikhail Gorbachev, you know, introduced reforms into the old Soviet Union, dissolved the Warsaw Pact, and offered a model of peace to the world, I guess. Mm-hmm. And America, the United States, had a choice, which was, you know, do we make peace with the Soviet Union? Do we accept that the Soviet Union can change from being a, you know, a socialist state to being a market democracy, a social democracy. But there were many people in the US government who really weren't all that keen on that. They saw Gorbachev, the Soviet Union, as unreconstructed communists. And one of those key people was Dick Cheney. So there was this clear policy, I guess, under Reagan and really also led by George Bush, the elder Bush, HW, isn't it? Well, you know, Bush and Gorbachev were friends to some degree. And they worked together to sort of resolve the issues of post-Cold War diplomacy.
What I came away
but
with...
Dick Cheney intervened.
What I came away with listening to you, though, was, and you said something really interesting, and I found it fascinating. You said George Bush decided at that time, and this would have been a moment that could have changed history, you play the cards that you're dealt. I think you said something like that. In other words... Whoever we get is you know, if it's this leader, this situation, we play. And Cheney said, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to change the cards and create a new deck, right?
The phrase he used, George Bush, was you dance with whoever is on the dance card.
There you go, sorry.
So it's very, very sort of 1950s sort of metaphor. But he actually recorded in his personal sort of tape recorder, in his sort of personal diary, so to speak, this reflection. And he said, the one thing you don't want to do is destabilization.
So,
and that was what Cheney opposed. Cheney wanted actively to break up the Soviet Union, to break up Russia ultimately as well.
So then you get to the point where you say they essentially used Ukraine as the perfect tool to be able to do that. If they can create that wedge between Ukraine and the Soviet Union, what used to be the Soviet Union, the new Russia, and they were going to go through a really difficult time here in Moscow because of that whole time, which is not the fault of the United States. It's just it's a transitional period, right? But the United States, Dick Cheney in particular, wanted to use the Ukrainians for that purpose. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. He was involved with the National Endowment of Democracy. He actively supported the various nationalist groups within Ukraine, and he saw Ukraine as the way in which to get the party started, I guess. Now, there were also lots of other things going on within the Soviet Union that were contributing to this, you know, instability, and 1991 was a very difficult year for the Soviet Union. But in that year, Gorbachev was pleading with Bush Senior for, you know, economic support to help him get through this transition. And the Secretary of State, James Baker, was similarly supportive of helping a reformed, renewed, you know, Soviet Union sort of coexist with the United States, not being in any direct threat. But Cheney, as well as some of the sort of other hardliners within the cabinet, really chose to fuel the nationalism, fuel the separatism, and really actively set out to destroy the Russian or the Soviet economy so that they could not ever be a sort of defense force again.
Is it fair to say?
So,
is it fair to say then that the Soviet Union at the time, which was about to become the Russian Federation, poured their heart out to the United States and said, help us, we want to be your friend. We want to try and work with you. Help us become more like you. And the United States essentially said, sure, that's exactly what we're going to do. Wink, wink. And in fact, what they did was completely the opposite. Is that a fair characterization that people like Cheney, for example, pulled off?
Yeah, it is. And like the G7 as well, or the G8, I guess, was part of it as well, and quite a few of the European states and Canada as well. I think it was Brian Mulroney at the time, felt really quite remorseful about how they had betrayed Gorbachev and refused to give him aid. There was a proposal for an economic aid package to help them sort of manage some debts and some economic transition issues of approximately like $100 billion in that year's money, which, you know, if they had done, the Soviet Union would have, you know, got through its economic transition problems just as Poland and some of the other ex-Soviet states did in the late 1980s, early 1990s. But the US actively pursued a policy of refusing that aid. And Gorbachev was furious, and it really undermined the sort of internal stability within Ukraine, and then set off a whole you know chain of events as well. And that was an active policy. It was actively described by the Treasury Secretary and by Cheney, the Defense Secretary, as a policy of aggression to sort of knock out the Soviet economy.
In other words, we'll promise them some funding, some money to help them along the way to kind of get them started so that they can improve their economy and get going. But then we're not going to deliver on it, and that's going to make it even worse for them.
Even worse, Rick, it's sort of like kicking your friend when they're down and then stealing their money and the wallet and watch and you know, everything on their clothes.
I hate to put it on these terms because you don't want to besmirch people when, you know, who knows why they did it. But what I'm thinking in my mind right now, just thinking through this, is that's not something you're going to be able to do to Vladimir Putin, trust me, or Sergei Lavrov, or a lot of other people that I've come to know since I've been here in this new Russian Federation. But it seemed like at that moment, and I don't want to be critical of him because it was a difficult time, and who knows what any one of us would have done, but it seemed like at the time there were some suckers in that moment here in Moscow. Who were those suckers? Was it Gorbachev? Was it Yeltsin? What does history tell us in your regard?
Gorbachev's a particularly complex figure, but in some ways he transitioned the Soviet Union from the, you know, Communist Party socialist state to a kind of, you know, aspirant social democracy.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really well fitted to managing. He was used to Communist Party politics. He wasn't used to democratic politics, and in a way, he sort of struggled in that environment.
Sounds like you're saying he was over his head. Sounds like you're saying that we have an expression in America: he's in over his head.
Yeah. There was an element of that. I mean, in a way, he was a great visionary, and you know, let's remember what he did do: Glasnost, Perestroika, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But also, in a way, the international politics, his international friendships as well, became something of a compensation, as they often do for political leaders, for, you know, the frustrations of domestic policy. But Boris Yeltsin played a particularly destructive role, and, you know, actively courted, I guess, the Americans like Cheney, who wanted to sort of switch loyalties from Gorbachev to Yeltsin, and then that sort of fueled the separatism of the different republics.
Say that again. What do you think Yeltsin did wrong, looking back on it in hindsight, historically?
Well, he actively undermined Gorbachev. He actively undermined Gorbachev very, very much. So I think the historian Sheila Fitzpatrick, who's an Australian, very distinguished historian of the Soviet Union, refers to the relationship there as she refers to Princess Di's comment that you know, the problem with her marriage was there were three people in it, and part of the issue with negotiating the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union at the end was there were three people in it. There was the American president, and there was Gorbachev, and then there was Yeltsin. So he played for all sorts of reasons, and Gorbachev perhaps was not so skillful in handling Yeltsin, who was perhaps more of a democratic politician, a populist sort of politician, and was also prepared to play with the sort of nationalist forces and the like, the Ukrainian nationalists, the separatists in the Baltic republics, etc. So, yeah, that's really the sort of destructive role that Yeltsin played. I guess there was naivety from Gorbachev as well, so there was plenty of blame, but there were also some pretty cynical operators in the United States.
Well, yeah, exactly. A lot. I mean, we just did a story yesterday here about what the United States just tried to do in Bangladesh, where they basically interfered because they wanted to remove Hassini, I believe, the prime minister, back in 2024. We know what the United States just recently did in Romania. I mean, we know that the MI6, the CIA, the Mossad, USAID, I mean, this is what they do. This is what they've been doing in Latin America for many years. So it's unfair to say, oh, it's, you know, Yeltsin was a sucker and he got stooged into this thing. No, I mean, he was messing with some really good operators who are pros. They know how to do this stuff. Yeah. So I get it. But I'm particularly interested in what happened. Let's go beyond that now and talk about Ukraine and maybe some of the other republics. So we know what happened in Ukraine around 2014 and possibly before that, because we know that NATO saw Ukraine as the Mac Daddy. We got to get Ukraine. If we get Ukraine and we turn it on Russia, then we can get the Russians to weaken and et cetera, et cetera. So we know that story. But the period before that, from, let's say, the mid-90s all the way through 2005 or something like that, that's when it wasn't necessarily Obama and Biden and those folks. It was somebody else, right? What were they doing in Ukraine? How did they mischievously create this opposition in Ukraine to weaken Russia? And who did it?
Well, the Ukrainian nationalist forces were always there from, you know, 1945, and the American government through the CIA had worked with them throughout that time as a, you know, attempt to undermine the Soviet Union from within. So, you know, the infamous Stepan Bandera was you know, given safe custody out of the country and employed by, used by the CIA in various ways. And there were, you know, many, many other people of similar ilk. So there was this long-standing relationship. But in 1991, what is really, you know, astonishing and quite striking is there's actually a, you know, documented meeting in the White House Situation Room where they're arguing about what they should do about this sort of Ukrainian independence vote. And James Baker, who's the Secretary of State, says, you know, I'm really worried that we will have another Yugoslavia on our hands if we keep pursuing this Cheney policy of destabilization, and we don't want to have that kind of violence. And what happens if if we also go down that route? We will probably make worse the situation in Ukraine about the sort of extreme nationalism and the sort of separatists or the internal frictions within Ukraine. And he says, you know, we will end up with a civil war between involving the Donbass, Crimea, and eastern Ukraine. And this is spoken by the US Secretary of State in 1991. Wow. And it's astonishing to read. And at the same time, there's, you know, a debate going on about nuclear weapons, not just for Ukraine, but also for Kazakhstan, which had, you know, quite a few nuclear weapons installed in that country. And there was a decision the US had to make about, you know, did I work with the Soviet Union to make sure, you know, one stable state controls, you know, the world's largest nuclear arsenal? And Dick Cheney said, doesn't really matter. Let's give the nukes to Ukraine. At least they won't be pointed at us, he sort of said. So
wow.
It's extraordinarily reckless. And of course, as we know, at the sort of onset in 2022, one of the decision-making factors, I would imagine, for the Russian government was the Ukrainian government, the Zelensky's plea for Ukraine to have, you know, have nuclear weapons, to make this argument that, you know, we should get our nukes back because we lost them back in 1991.
You know what's fascinating, I really find fascinating about what you're saying is I'm putting myself, or trying to put myself, historically in this moment, and I'm thinking to myself, in 1991 or thereabouts, James Baker was a big-time player. Everybody knew who James Baker was, and he was a very powerful man. Some people would argue the most powerful in the White House, right? And you're telling me that in that moment, he was arguing for being careful when it comes to Ukraine. Don't break it up. Don't let it become another Yugoslavia, as you said. And then there's this guy, Dick Cheney, who at the time, nobody knew who the hell Dick Cheney was. I mean, he was kind of a newbie at the time. And yet you're saying, and this is why I think what you're writing and saying is so fascinating, it was actually Dick Cheney who won the moment, right? And who set the course for what we're dealing with now.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly right. I mean, he was the defense secretary, so I mean that's more than just a newbie, I guess.
Yeah, you're right.
And he had been part of, he'd been like Donald Rumsfeld's sort of offsider. He'd been part of the inner elite, I guess, for 20 years.
But you get my point. He wasn't James Baker.
Yeah. He was not James Baker, but but James Baker basically pursued a policy of winning the peace at the end of the Cold War, whereas Dick Cheney and others, there was like the Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady and others, they pursued a policy of starting Cold War II and asserting the unipolar dominance of the United States. So this is the era of Wolfowitz, the Wolfowitz doctrine, all that kind of thing. So it was this sort of shift from saying, we live in balance, I guess, with other powers around the world, to we want to completely dominate the world. And that is the absolutely tragic, I mean, that's the most tragic choice, I think, at least, America made certainly in the 1990s. And if you think about what the consequences for the world has been, it's just astonishing.
And the guys there now are really followers of the Cheney ideology, if you will. I mean, it's almost like I'm thinking this in two terms, right? I mean, if Baker had won, we would have seen a different world. And things would be, I think, better, my opinion. Yeah. But we followed the other course. And I'm looking now at the guys who replaced the Cheneys, et cetera, in the Biden, Clinton, Bush, Trump administrations. And they all follow the same course. They all sound like Dick Cheney. And it doesn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans. So it's continued on.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see, one of the key issues, too, is what to have done with NATO and the American military presence in Europe. Because, you know, arguably after the Soviet Union had dissolved the Warsaw Pact, after Gorbachev had said, you know, let's be friends, America could have said, okay, you know, Europe's a pretty safe, prosperous and secure place now, and it looks like Europe and Russia are or the Soviet Union is, you know, getting along quite well. Mm-hmm. And they were getting along quite well. And a lot of the Europeans actually wanted to strengthen the economic, social, other sort of cultural relationships with Europe. But this was part of the thing, I think, that turned Bush's decision making. It was, you know, a key factor in his decision making in the end, which was that America wasn't prepared to let go of its stabilizing presence in Europe. It wanted to, keep all the bases, keep all the other things, and you know, in the context of the first Gulf War, Europe is also a forward base of operation. It's that those huge military bases in Germany, et cetera, are key sort of logistics points, I guess, for operations in the Middle East.
Final point. And again, I'm listening to you, and you're a smart man, And you're giving me a lot of new data that I've never had in my head, which is fascinating, good research. I think, based on what you're saying, that if that was the plan of Mr. Cheney's and others, it's kind of backfired. I think as a result of this policy, Russia is now perhaps as strong or stronger than it's ever been. What do you think?
Well, I think so. I mean, the explicit intention was to turn Russia into a third-rate power, to strip it of its wealth so that it could never be a defense power. Mm-hmm. For the first 10 years or so, I mean, they made some progress with that, didn't they? And, you know, tragically so. And if you think, I mean, that's a kind of economic and social war on another country, which is, you know, deeply immoral if you think of what happened in Russia and the post-Soviet states in the 1990s. But, you know, ever since 1999, the sort of self-strengthening within Russia has happened. And again, that's part of the tragedy of Ukraine, because Ukraine sort of went down the temptation of pandering, I guess, to those sort of interests, and never really did the sort of kind of reforms and institutional changes that happened in the, getting rid of the oligarchs and all those sorts of things that did happen in the Soviet Union, in Russia, and led to sort of better outcomes. So, yeah, I do think it has changed in a way that same dilemma is being represented to Europe and to the United States and to Russia today, which is, how do we manage the collective security of Europe after, in our real conditions today, not as they were in 1945. Do we really still need to have all those American soldiers, all those American bases, all those American missiles pointed at a country that, basically just wants to get along?
Yeah.
In a way, weakening this, using Europe as a forward base of operations of American dominance rather than looking at a genuine way to protect the defense and security of Europe.
You are a delight to talk to. You're a really smart guy, and I'm fascinated by the way you've been able to present this. It's so nice to have you on all the way down there under from Melbourne, Australia. And thanks so much. Thanks for giving us your time and sharing some of your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much, Rick. It was a real pleasure.
And if somebody wants to reach you, what do they do?
Well, the best thing is to go to jeffrich.substack.com. That's where I do all my writing on Substack. I'm actually about to do a series on Russian history. And also check out my YouTube channel, the Burning Archive YouTube channel.
That's great. I'm so glad that we found you. Thank you so much. Take care, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rick.
Hundreds of you have been liking and commenting on some of our programs recently, especially some of the ones that we did just the other day. In fact, here's some of the comments that you've shared with us. Dan G says, American politicians say they want the best for the American people, but then in the end, it's the politicians and their friends who end up with the best. And it's all the people's expense. Good point. Abraham says, love you guys, from Nigeria, no less. Thank you, Abraham. I always enjoy hearing you speak the truth wherever you guys are. It's the uphill task saying reporting the truth in a perverse world we're in right now. So dangerous today, more than ever. Please continue this sacred war against lies and deception, which pervades the ruling elites all over the world. Thank you, Abraham, for the kind comments. Paco Santino says, I'm telling you, this channel is going to explode. Besides YouTube bias, 10,000 followers in a week? Keep it coming, Rick. I'll try. Thanks, man. Appreciate the encouragement. Anonymous says, maybe Trump can solve the 341st war now. Duda says, what a conversation. So much content, but effortlessly conveyed. Effortlessly, sorry. Love that energy. We thank you for that. We do love to really hear from you guys, and it's always so kind to hear what you have to say. And remember, don't feel like you have to give me compliments. If you've got something critical, you don't like something we're doing, you disagree with a point I make or one of the guests, please, we will certainly put those at the top next time we get a chance to speak with you. But for the most part, you guys kind of like what we're doing, and that makes us feel good. Thank you so much. I'm Rick Sanchez. You can check us out if you want to leave a comment at Journalistically Speaking. I read almost everything that is written there. Also on X, on Twitter, whatever you want to call it, at Rick Sanchez TV. Go to Rick Sanchez TV. That's where you find me. I'll be looking for you the next time. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes. Bye-bye.